Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, and Bristol's first podcast is back at our new Friday afternoon 2 o'clock slot. This week, we continue our look at homelessness in the city with so little press coverage of the shocking figure of 19,000 people waiting to be properly housed in the city, and the 1.75 million square feet of empty office space in Bristol. Our basic needs are not being addressed, and none of the main parties seems to have a plan. Also, it's the magic mushroom season, so why is possession of these mushrooms illegal? And what are the dangers? Also, we have the weekly What's On Guide and Song of the Week from Jeff Sparks. Dialect is produced by volunteers and is broadcast in Bristol on BCFM 93.2 every Friday afternoon. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, whose office is just off Queen Square. We recommend the volunteer-run Bully Watch helpline, aimed mostly at school children and parents. The number is 01454 318 753, and we'll have a reminder of the phone numbers for both Volunteering Bristol and Bully Watch at the end of the show. So we start this week with squatting, and in the news has been the bank squat. That is to say, in Clifton, certain squatters have moved into a former bank. Now, I'm joined by Irina Bondaruk. Irina, you were on here a couple of weeks ago. Can you tell us a little bit about this bank squat, and you know, what's the point of squatting a bank?
Hello, Tony. Bank squat. I haven't really been there. I haven't been involved.
But I'm just asking you about the sort of point of squatting a bank.
Well, Canada residential buildings, so bank is non-residential, I suppose.
Okay, so this business of the new law is affecting things a little bit, isn't it?
Definitely,
What's your own situation now? Because you were squatting, you now got somewhere to live, I think.
Yeah, at last I got a room with a housing benefit, so I'm not really homeless anymore, but it was very difficult.
Now, the idea of squatting this bank, that whole point of that, really, it seems to me, is to sort of make the point about the banks. What's your own feeling about the financial crisis? Because I think it's fair to say that a lot of people in society, particularly on the fringes of it, have kind of lost faith in the banking system and the ability of money to do its job in society.
Oh, my personal opinion, you know, I don't really believe in money at all.
Well, you've got to believe in money because you need it to survive.
Not really, no.
Why not?
For 7 years I lived without money and it was fine.
Now, hang on. How can you live without money? I mean, you've got to eat, you've got to pay the rent, you've got to get electricity, these kinds of things.
Kind of, but there are ways to get around it, like freeganism and stuff.
Okay, freeganism, what's that?
That's living for free, but it's not exactly living for free the way the people think. Like, it's not really for free, it involves like more work and going around skips and...
But I mean, you know, for most people, they don't want to go to the skips around the back of a supermarket to get their food.
Yeah, well then people obviously have to pay, or they have to go to charities to...
Yeah, I mean, have you actually lived like that much then, where you've really been dependent on just throwaway food? I mean, face it, there's a lot of waste in society.
Yeah, there is a lot of waste in society, especially like in Western society. And it's absolutely possible to live off skips. I mean, it's still better than probably in most of African countries.
Now you're from Lithuania originally. How does the ability... I mean, is it different in Lithuania? Is it still easy or possible anyway to live with no money at all?
It's different. When I say like I lived 7 years without money, it doesn't really mean that I was squatting and skipping for 7 years. For example, living with my boyfriend whose parents are very rich, also got involved me to live without money because I wasn't paying for anything myself anyway.
Well, that helps, doesn't it? And in fact, there's probably quite a lot of people now, young people whose parents are incredibly wealthy, who they don't actually earn any money. You know, they're going to university. So in a way, you're in a similar situation to that, were you?
Kind of, yeah.
Also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Now, Martin and I usually spend our times on the Friday evening show, the Drive Time show, from 5 till 7 every Friday. Martin, can I get your take on this idea of living for free? Because, I mean, certainly if there's a financial crash or really difficult financial problems, people are going to, you know, be in debt. They're going to almost be forced to live for free, aren't they?
Well, we're seeing this increasingly all over the world, where people basically who thought of themselves as sort of stable, respectable people end up queuing up for food, sleeping in their cars and what have you. And there's going to be an awful lot more of that. I think there's no point making judgments about other people's survival strategies. There's a very interesting programme on BBC at the moment, Welcome to India, which is showing survival strategies of very poor people in India. And they don't live without any money, you know, but they struggle every day to make a few rupees. And millions of people all over the world live literally hand-to-mouth like that. And more people are going to be doing so as we go forward into this crisis.
Now, if we go back enough time, you know, people didn't have... I mean, OK, it's a long way to go back to Roman times, but there really wasn't such a formal reliance on money before that, where people had their own homes on a piece of land, they didn't have to pay any rent. Also, they were growing their own food. Now, we've come a long way since then. So how is this all going to end? Because we are now really dependent on money.
Well, the money system has been with us for quite a long time. The fact of the matter is that we should, in fact, be encouraging people to live on their own land. I mean, in Lithuania in the 90s, when I worked there, what had happened was the collective farms had collapsed and people had been given their individual holdings to grow a bit of food for themselves. But, of course, don't forget, it's very cold in Lithuania for most of the year. It's not actually, you don't actually grow enough. You need to sell something. And so these small farmers were selling milk to the mafia. And the mafia were then selling the milk on to the pensioners on very limited money in the cities at a massive markup. And any farmer that tried to sell directly to the pensioners got their legs broken. This is the kind of structure that develops. And you can't just opt out of the society. All of these small farmers had their own little farm, unlike under the previous setup, but they were actually still at the mercy of a power structure.
Yeah, can I just add something? Really, another way of like living for free and avoiding money is basically community living, community produce. People are dependent on money in towns where the money becomes the main exchange rate type of thing. But if people actually do produce something themselves, they just can share and swap things they produce, and this is the way of living without money.
I mean, the thing is, to produce something, either that being food or goods that you can sell, you need space. But I mean, if you've got no money, you can't pay the rent to buy the space. I suppose for a lot of people, the only option is either doing a very low paid job where you're just able to feed yourself and you can't actually produce anything else, or else squatting.
Well, effectively, in Latin America, the landless peasants movement have been doing exactly that. They've been squatting land, then basically growing food on it and daring the authorities to kick them off. And a lot of people have died in this struggle. It's the Via Campesina, as they call it in Latin America, the way of the peasants. And what we really need to see is two things. In countries which still have excess of land, like Brazil and Colombia, we should be encouraging people to go to the land and basically make themselves secure. And we should also be protecting the rights of workers who are in work, so that the people can then move between these two worlds, between being a peasant farmer and being a worker. And if you think back to France in the 1950s, this was quite a common pattern, where people would have a farm and work part-time in a factory. Now, that is the way to actually really seriously improve living conditions around the world. But of course, the powers that be do not want that. It gives too much power to the people in the bottom, too much bargaining power. So they don't want to have land and they don't want to have protection through unions.
But listen, I mean, in a democracy, surely you're going to have some party emerge which is going to offer power to this majority of people, the poorer section of society.
Well, we've just seen in Venezuela, Hugo Chavez being re-elected for the, I don't know, it's the fifth or sixth time for another 6 years. And yes, there are politicians out there who are promising these things and delivering.
Not in Britain.
Not yet.
Do you think that it will take some sort of a deepening of the financial crisis then, Martin? Before, I mean, traditionally this was a kind of Labour Party point of view. I know after the Second World War, the Labour Party were actually talking about nationalising land, and then instead what came along was the Town and Country Planning Act, and I think that was about 1947-48, and that was the idea then, was to nationalise the whole process of building and development, you know, which was one step removed from nationalising land. But what has this all got to do with the way we view land as private property and trade it and buy and sell land? Because if you go back far enough, that didn't happen. And also, this is one of the things that you were talking about, Latin America, people like the Movimento Sem Terra in Brazil, the landless movement over there. That what they do is they see land as something which is there for everyone, and they just need it, so they go and take it. They squat in and literally hundreds and sometimes thousands of people at once will go and take a piece of land.
Well, that's right. But of course, you've got to distinguish between who ultimately owns land. And if you say you had land nationalisation, that would be the society at large, and who's actually using it now. And nobody can use the same bit of land. I can't use the same bit of land as you, can I? So there's got to be some rules about distribution. And so you saw in Poland, for example, at the end of World War II, the communist government gave all the peasants 7 acres each, 7 hectares each. And the goal there was that 7 hectares would be too small, and therefore they would have to cooperate, and then, of course, they would be open to collectivisation. In Lithuania, they were collectivised. But they found that the peasants were actually able to make those 7 hectares viable, and so they were never able to collectivise them, although they tried. And after 1956, the communist government in Poland gave up trying to collectivise peasantry. But of course, what you've still got in Poland is perhaps a third of the population directly or indirectly working on the land. So, you know, the little shops that they use and so on, they're also dependent upon the rural population. But most of those people are bankrupt and have been destroyed by international capitalist unfair competition, which is actually, you know, so they survived the communists, the Nazis, and along comes the multinational companies, and their way of life's destroyed.
So how big does a piece of land need to be viable then, do you think? I mean you were talking about hectares then. You know, an acre is a bit easier, isn't it, because it's a football field. How much are we roughly talking about that they were given?
Not very big. It's not a lot of a hectare is bigger than
isn't it about a couple of acres or something?
7 hectares is fine. It's just fine for having like a house and self-sustainable, like, garden allotment type of thing.
Because, of course,
you can grow quite a few, like, things on the land.
The style of farming of Polish peasants is more like gardening. Yeah, they dig things over by... The poor ones have just spades. The middle ones have a horse, and the very few have a tractor. So you're talking about people using land very, very intensively.
It's
not like we do with huge, big fields.
It's more like a sort of allotment approach, isn't it? A big allotment or something. The other thing, of course, is we're in a situation now with the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer, that a lot of the rich don't trust the stock market so much. So they've really started investing in property, in land. And I know that the trouble is, right, if you want to be able to sell your land, the best thing to do is to keep it vacant. So we're ending up with quite a lot of houses. We've got something like, was it you were saying earlier, Irina, I think 800,000 houses in Britain empty, and vast areas. Vast areas of offices, massive areas of offices. Tony Crofts came up with this figure of 1.75 million square feet of Bristol's offices are empty. That's because that property, to be able to sell it quickly, it's worth something like 20 to 30% more if it's empty. So there's a big financial incentive, Martin, in making empty, in just keeping property empty. So we're ending up with a situation where we've got nearly 20,000 homeless people, and yet the other half, the 1%, if you want, have got all this property that they just don't want anyone anywhere near it, so they can sell it quickly and make a bit more than if there was someone in it.
It's not even to sell it, it's so that the price, because it's empty, the value of it goes up, but you don't sell it, you then put it on your books as of that value, and that means that, say, you're a bank or something like that, that comes onto your books as an asset, and that means that you're solvent and that you can carry on doing things and so on. It's an irrationality. And as Ron Stone was pointing out on our show on Friday last week...
Yeah, he's the Labour councillor for St George West.
He's pushing, and Manchester City Council have decided to do this, that these empty office spaces should be bought up and turned into housing for people on the waiting list. Now, it's an obvious thing to do, but everybody will go, you can't do that, and the answer is, why not? We could, if we wanted to.
Irina, you know, you when you were squatting, now you've got somewhere more permanent, and that's great. But when you were squatting, did you find that there was actually quite a lot of buildings around that were empty and that, you know, you and your friends could move into?
There are quite a lot of empty buildings around, council properties, non-council properties, residential, non-residential. Not that many that they would be obviously everywhere, but everyone can just notice, even the estate agents adverts on the street. Sometimes it's the whole street just for rent.
Well, we've got Cumberland Street, haven't we, which is just around the back of the Holiday Inn on by the Bear Pit at the bottom of Stokes Croft. That whole street, one side of it, which is actually ironically where the council's hub used to be, which was the homeless centre. If you were homeless, you went there to sign on the housing register. One entire side of that street, which is about probably 10-12 office buildings or houses converted into office buildings, is empty. It's all boarded up. You know, we're getting to the stage where the system is sort of breaking down. Irina, how have you found that the change of the law has affected things, you know, with the move away from residential squatting, the criminalisation of residential squatting?
Well, once again, if you're poor, you have to go to jail. No one really wants to go to jail anyway.
And one of the first, well, in fact, the first person in Bristol to actually be subject to these new laws, the criminalisation of residential squats, will be joining us. He's Henry, and he'll be joining us after some music. Jam, and David Watts. I'm Tony Gosling, and this is Dialect. Now, we are joined by Henry, who was one of, if not the first person in Bristol to be treated by the police, really, with this new criminalisation of residential squatting. Hi, Henry, and welcome to Dialect. Now, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? How did you find yourself in a situation where you needed somewhere to live?
Well, I was renting previously in Bath. I was lodging with a couple there and using housing benefit. And I'd got to the point where I was looking for something different, and I knew some people in the activist scene in Bath who referred me to BAM as a place to find accommodation in Bristol. That's Bristol Housing Action Movement. And so I got in touch with them, and they found me a squat to stay in for a bit. And then eventually we found a new building to squat, which was the council flat, which we stayed in for a bit.
Okay, so you say you were talking about yourself and we. I mean, part of the journey, was it meeting up with other people who were in a similar situation to you?
Sorry?
Was part of finding somewhere to live also meeting up with other people? Because, I mean, I would imagine this is not the sort of thing you want to do on your own, really. It's a good idea to have maybe at least one other person in the same squat. Otherwise, as soon as you go out, the landlord will come back and change all the locks again, and that's it. You need, you know, you're out.
Yeah, usually you need a team of a few people, certainly. We were never able to find really enough people to hold that flat, so we actually stayed in it in what is in squatting quite an unusual method, where we didn't really lock it up when we left. I have very, very little stuff, so I kind of left it open, and we managed to kind of keep it that way for a couple of weeks until we were evicted.
Now, you know, you're in this situation, but I mean, ultimately, surely the council, you know, what you're doing is treading on toes, isn't it? Because the council need that flat, and they wanted, I imagine, to rent it out to somebody rather than to have you squat it.
Well, it had been left unused for a while.
Do you know how long?
I don't know personally, but I'd heard that it was like something like a year.
Okay. And where was it? In a bunch of other flats, or just all on its own, or what?
It was in a larger building, which was separated up into flats. Whether the council owned all of it, I'm not sure. But certainly, yeah, it was part of a larger building.
And so it must have been a little bit strange. You know, you haven't got a lot of stuff, but you're going in and out, and you're actually leaving the door open while you're living in there. Did you have neighbours?
The window open.
The window, right. But I mean, did you have neighbours? What did they think of what you were up to?
Yeah, I ran into one of the neighbours on one of the days, and he sort of poked my head out of the window, I was letting someone else in, and he said, are you squatting? And I said, yes, and there was a kind of pause, and I waited to see what he would say, and he said, oh, no problem with that. So I had a bit of a chat with him. He'd been into the flat and kind of had a look around and things like that.
Himself? So, oh, okay.
Yeah, so he seemed fine with it, and yeah, that was the contact with the neighbours, really.
Did you ever figure out why the council left the flat empty for quite a long time, or not?
No, that was something that we didn't ever work
maybe,
out.
Maybe, I mean, I'm guessing, and maybe I can bring you again in here, Martin, that for quite a lot of the social housing people, such as the city council, that they are reluctant to spend money on renovating places and doing them up and getting them back into a condition where they can be rented out. I mean, Henry, what sort of state was the place in?
As far as I could see, it was in a fine state. It didn't need any work that I could see. I mean, I'm not a kind of trained eye on these things, but running water, electricity, I think, and yeah, it didn't seem to be in a state where anyone couldn't have moved in.
Well, it's the same, Martin, isn't it, in London, with the place where this chap was evicted, we were talking about before the music. That was also a housing association place, and that had been left empty for a long time. Why do social housing providers, like housing associations and councils, why do they leave these places empty when there's such a desperate need for housing?
There'll probably be a different explanation in each case. And I think that, you know, that one of the problems you're going to have, you mentioned electricity there. I mean, while squatting was a civil offence, you as a squatter can get the electricity and the gas put on and pay a bill. And I used to be a squatter years ago, and that's exactly what we did. And so you're not stealing electricity or gas or anything like that, because squatting is legal. But now squatting is criminalised, you might find that electricity and gas companies are unwilling to deal with squatters and so on, which again makes it more difficult for people to squat. But, you know, the fact of the matter is, as we pointed out earlier, there are thousands and thousands of people, particularly young people, who find it very difficult to find anywhere to live. And people who think that there's loads of places to live out there just don't know what it's like. And ultimately, this crisis is going to, you know, in the US, people, as I say, sleep in tent cities and so on. That's where we're going here.
Henry, just tell us about your encounter with the police then when they came along to evict you.
Right, well, the council turned up first and gave me sort of note. Some said, you know, the police will be here in about 10 minutes. We suggest that you get your stuff, because if you haven't got it all by the time they're here, we'll lock it up and you won't get your stuff. So I got everything of mine and everything that other people had left there that I felt was important, got that out. The police turned up once I had got out of the flat. The police asked me some questions about another guy in the squatting scene who they seemed to want to talk to for some reason. And then they went into the flat themselves and had a look around, and I sort of waited to see what would happen. And once they noticed that I was waiting, they said, better luck next time. And I was a bit surprised that that was their response, their reaction, so I kind of must have had quite a quizzical look, and the guy said, oh, with whatever accommodation you find next, with finding accommodation.
Okay, I mean, you know, so really, in a way, you know, they may have potentially arrested you, but you decided, look, I don't want to have a fight here. Had you actually changed the locks, and, you know, had you, at that point, or was it
no,
still
this
not?
No, this was extremely low-impact squatting. We
yes,
hadn't
it is,
changed
isn't
the
it?
Locks. All that I'd done to the building is to sort of close up the window that we'd come through, which couldn't be secured, which is how we got into the flat. And so I secured that window completely so it couldn't be opened, and then we opened and shut another one so that we could secure it when we were in there. We could lock that window. So that's all that we did to the flat. So we didn't change the locks or anything like that. We didn't even have a Section 6 up while we were in there.
Now, the Section 6 is a notice that you put on the door to say this place is squatting, and it's a... do you know if it's Section 6 of what?
I've no idea.
something like a Housing Act or some kind of Act of Parliament, anyway, which does actually lay out squatters' rights. I know those notices have changed now, and it makes it clear that it excludes residential properties, saying, for example, this is not a residential property. The interesting thing about this new bank squat up in Clifton, which I think is being evicted this week, potentially, anyway, but that was quick, you know, only after about 2 weeks or so. The thing is, it actually looks like a house, but it's got planning permission as an office, and it's been converted for use as offices.
Yeah, it's definitely not a residential place. It does look like it, and Simon was very clear, one of the guys who was living there. When he talked to the police, he was very definite with them about it looks like a residential, but it isn't. And he showed them a floor plan of the building, which says office, office, office for all the different floors. So, yeah, it's definitely not a residential building. It doesn't, yeah.
I mean, what's your thoughts as someone who's squatting yourself about this change in the law then, Henry?
Change in the law. I find it strange. I think, like, as far as I can understand, the reason that Section 6 is a part of the law originally is that it protects tenants in buildings from being forcibly evicted by their landlords, and that squatters are people who use this hindrance on forcible eviction to kind of buy themselves time in buildings, so that they have to be evicted through a civil procedure. They can't just be have the door broken down. And why that ever applied to commercial buildings is a bit of an odd thing for me. I'm not sure why that law did ever apply to commercial buildings, but now that's all it applies to. But it seems that this law has transcended its original use and is now something that is to do with a relationship with homeless people, and the fact that there's some sense in which society accepts that homeless people could have some right to squat in an abandoned building, to live there. And that's been limited now from residential to commercial because of, as far as I can understand it, it's to do with stories in the press about squatters taking over other people's homes while they've been away on holiday and this sort of thing. And that's presented an area where someone else is living in this building, so it's not abandoned, and squatters have kind of been left with commercial buildings as a kind of, you can have this.
Martin, have you got any thoughts about this? I mean, why is it that Ken Clark, when he was Justice Secretary, has decided to I mean, he's an interesting character in itself. You know, he's one of the main conveners of the International Bilderberg Conferences. He's also a former chairman of British American Tobacco, a bit of a big shot. But he's decided that residential properties should not be, people should not be allowed to squat in those, but they should be in commercial properties, business properties, warehouses. I mean, the thing is, the thing I'd like an explanation of is, you know, obviously a residential property is designed for people to live in, so that's the one place we're told that homeless people can't go.
Well, I mean, what we're dealing with here, as Henry pointed out, is stuff in the press about people having their homes taken over when they're on holidays, which is may occasionally happen, but I think it's extremely rare. And it's just politicking with an extremely powerful social issue. Homelessness, particularly amongst young people, when we've got 25-30% unemployment amongst young people, qualified young people are leaving school and universities and colleges with no prospects. They are criminalising a whole generation of people. And the first person in Britain who was sent to prison for squatting the other week was actually an apprentice bricklayer. And he then gets sent to prison for 3 months, costing the taxpayer goodness knows what. And when he comes out, his apprenticeship will be over and he's not going to be able to get himself a job.
Well, the interesting thing
is... This is a war on the poor.
Well, the interesting thing is, of course, that money is no longer being spent by the government. It's being actually paid to, increasingly, to commercial businesses like Wackenhut, and there are various other ones that are running these private prisons.
Well, G4S.
And G4S, yeah.
Well, I mean, we can see what's happening here, and I think it's very unwise of the government. I mean, there's basically a very well-established squatting procedure in this country, which has grown up over generations now. And basically, everybody knows what the rules are, what the limits are, what places are available to squat and what are not available to squat. And there's a civil procedure for evicting people, and everybody knows what, and it creates a safety valve. But if the government is insisting on criminalising all of those people, don't be surprised if they start acting like criminals. And what I'm hinting at is the sort of thing we saw last August. And we can have a lot more of that if that's what the people at the top want. And that's what they're going to get if they're not careful.
Now, you say a safety valve. You say you try and imply there that if someone leaves a building empty for too long, that then they're leaving it open to the potential for squatting, and then a financial penalty of some sort is on them. Because at the moment, there really is no financial penalties on people that leave buildings empty, incredibly.
Well, indeed, if there was a proper housing policy... I mean, in many other Northern European countries, there's plenty of houses for people because that's been planned for years. In Britain, we've not built any serious social housing for at least a generation, and we've got a whole backlog of people coming onto the market for needing homes who can't find them. And this has actually been a disaster waiting to happen. And basically, what's the matter with providing people with decent houses? I mean, that should be a basic function of the society. Why isn't it being done?
Henry, your situation, how's things now? Where have you got somewhere to live at the moment?
At the moment, I'm staying at the Pembroke, at the bank.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're actually at the bank?
Yeah.
Although possibly to be evicted later this week.
Evicted later this week. But, always keeping an eye open for other things. And one of the things about squatting, especially in Bristol, is that there's a massive community. There's a very strong sense of community. So a lot of people will be there to help if I need to find somewhere else to stay.
Now, you said at the beginning that you were paying rent in Bath and that you were claiming housing benefit for that from a local authority, I imagine from Bath Council, Bath North East Somerset or somebody like that. But you're not anymore. Why did you do that? Because, I mean, you know, surely it's better to be claiming this benefit and paying your rent rather than to be in this insecure housing situation.
I don't think so, because I don't agree with rent ethically. I think that it's a form of extortion, really. The person who's charging the rent isn't doing anything, and they're getting money for nothing, for the fact that they own the building.
No, but they've done something, they've worked in order to get the money to buy the house, haven't they?
Yes, and that's the way it's presented to me.
Or some of them have. Maybe their parents have given them the money, you know.
Yeah, but there's money invested in the house that's been used to build it. And if I was paying the money to pay off the money that's invested in the house to cover that, and at some point it would be paid off. That would be one thing. But if I'm paying money and someone is just getting all that profit, and that it's just going to profit, and it's not ever paying it off in the sense that I would then have paid it off and that it would be finished, that's not what's happening. What's happening is that that money is just going and going and going to someone, to the landlord or whoever they have to pay off if they're paying for their mortgage or whatever. It's not money. The money that I'm paying is not going towards the house.
Well, yeah, something. At least, what it's not doing is going towards your future anyway. Martin, do you think Henry's being a bit extreme when he's talking about rent as a form of extortion?
Well, I mean, what we've got is a situation where we have what is essentially a racket going on here. If you are middle class and you get on the housing ladder, you're basically going to get money for doing nothing. And people don't realise this. It's as much of a handout from society as housing benefit or unemployment benefit or sickness benefit. If your house rises in value in the way that it did in the last property bubble, that is a massive handout to the property classes. Now, a lot of people get in on this handout. All you've got to do is get on the housing ladder, but a lot of people can't afford to do that. And, of course, the Duke of Westminster is the biggest landowner in Britain. Every time houses rise in value or property rises in value, he becomes a multi-millionaire multi times over. And we've seen property values rise by, 50 to 100%. And that is for doing absolutely nothing. And that, whether people realise it or not, is a free handout from society. So all the Duke of Westminster's got to do is sit there as the biggest landowner in Britain, and the money comes rolling in. Now, he pretends to work, but he doesn't need to. This, of course, is a handout, which is exactly the point of nationalising land, or if you're not going to nationalise land, tax land when it's not being used. If somebody isn't living in the house or they're not using it for business, it should be taxed in such a way that they want to get it off their hands and so that it is brought into use. But if you do that, of course, the price of using things would go down. The price of using properties would go down, which of course would undermine the profit-making strategy of the property-owning classes. And this is basically, we've come to the end of the line of this in Britain. Ultimately, if they don't provide decent housing for people on low incomes, then they're not going to get anywhere to live. And that, of course, is going to lead to an awful lot of suffering and ultimately to a backlash.
Because, of course, this is housing is something that people spend most of their income on, isn't
it? Most, it's probably the most important thing of all.
A racket is quite a strong way of putting it, Martin, but it sounds like you two are almost agreeing there.
I did find that I could live on very, very little money except for rent. And that was covering so much of my money, and I was paying that out every day. And for what? It's not for a service, and it's not for goods. It's for something that's kind of strange and sort of nebulous, and I just couldn't work out why so much money was going towards that.
Well, I think what we've got is that the price of finding somewhere to live is deliberately and artificially kept high so that property values can be protected. So the interests of the property-owning classes come first. Now, there's been up to now, there's been a kind of, they've allowed squatting as a safety valve, but if they're now criminalising it, they've basically declared war on the poor. Now, a lot, of course, the poor don't have many tools to fight back with, but ultimately, this is going to backfire. I mean, in northern European countries that are properly managed, I'm thinking like Finland and places like that, there is no argument about housing. Everybody just has somewhere to live. And if in cold countries like that, you've got to make sure that everybody's got somewhere to live. And in Britain, there's a fantasy that everybody is going to own their own home, except that a large proportion of people are not. And what's going to happen to them?
Do you think there's a possibility that with the financial situation, Martin, that some of the parties, maybe the more left-wing parties, like the Labour Party, potentially might start coming up with policies which are more positive to do with housing and actually come into... I mean, it's a bit like full employment, isn't it? That used to be a very big objective of all the parties back in the 60s and 70s. It now seems to have gone out of the window. The same with housing.
Well, it's like pulling teeth. But eventually he saw Ed Balls, the Labour Shadow Chancellor, saying at the Labour Party conference that he was prepared to put some money into building social housing. I mean, I don't know why it's taken him so long to come around to this obvious conclusion, but one obvious way to protect the economy, protect the poor, and also kickstart the economy is to have a crash programme, not of house building, but perhaps of taking over these empty properties, which are not being used, and converting them not for people to buy, but for people to rent who are on low incomes. And The Labour Party will eventually come out with this, but they're scared of their own shadows. They're scared of the property-owning classes. And the property-owning classes are the people who vote, sadly, and a lot of the people who are the poor and the disenfranchised don't bother. And, of course, therefore, their interests are not represented.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. It sounds like what you're saying is that you would like the government to take over these empty commercial spaces, which are currently what people are looking to squat, and make them into rentable accommodation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I would have, personally, a lot of people perhaps wouldn't, but I personally would have a problem with that because of comes back to rent again, and unless it's a building where I'm paying it off in some way, then I just...
Well, that's being part, if you don't mind me saying so, of the property-owning delusion. What we need is access. I mean, in places like Switzerland, for example, even wealthy people don't buy their own homes. They rent from a huge spectrum of things that are available.
I'm in a housing association place, which I pay rent for, and that also pays for maintenance and things like that. So, you know, I don't have to fix, say, for example, the tap jams. You know, I don't have to fix it. Someone will come and fix
it. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that, but that, to me, doesn't come under rent. To me, rent comes under the fact that I'm paying to live there.
Yeah, and just a private... landlord is what you're
talking about. What we're doing here is arguing about the meaning of the word rent. I mean, in economics, the term economic rent has a specific meaning. And, of course, rent-seeking is where people get something for nothing. And I'm not talking about people squatting here. I'm talking about property-owning classes who get something for nothing. They don't actually contribute anything to get that reward. And this is the problem, is that their right to take that free money... And they don't even see it as free money. I mean, we've had people on our show, I won't mention any names, who are saying that they think that the people who live in their buy-to-let houses are feckless, work-shy people, etc., etc. So, but you take all that money from...
Housing's a conservative councillor.
The point is, what's really pernicious is people who have got several houses, rent them out to people on housing benefit, and then complain that the housing benefit bill's too big, even though they, in fact, are the ones who are receiving the money. The people who are living in the houses never see the housing benefit. I don't suppose you saw any of your housing benefit when you were living in Bath. It went straight from your hands to the you didn't see a penny of it, did you?
The other thing I like rather about Henry's point about rent is actually what we pay as rent, and also when we're paying off a mortgage, we pay far, far more than we should be for that. Houses are built for anything from a hunt to last for anything from 100, 200 years. They cost X amount to build. And what you should really be doing is getting that £1,000 over 200 years and splitting that up into how much it would cost to build. And that, I mean, we're not just talking about materials, we're talking about the labour costs to build the house. And if you sit down and do those calculations, they come out at somewhere between £2 and £6 a week for your accommodation. That's what we should
be
paying.
So what you're actually paying underlying value of the land.
It's not just that. No, yeah.
Which is, of course, being manipulated
two,
by these...
anyone own the land?
Two extra things. Well, that's I agree with that. We'll come to that in a second, but there's two things. There's firstly the land value, which is inflated, which you're paying for, and it's also the massive profit that the landlord's taking out over that period.
Yeah.
So what about this landowning business, Henry?
Yes, I mean, the question is that simple. Why should anyone own the land, and what right does anyone have to that land?
Well, one thing's for certain is that it's very difficult to equate land with some other kind of ordinary good which you can own, like, say, a car, because the land is a free gift to humanity. You know, it's not like somebody made it and they're selling it to you, unless it's God, possibly.
No, but I mean, what you'll find throughout history is that the land has been dominated by the property-owning classes who tend to run the show. And they, of course, whether we're talking about William the Conqueror or Lord the Duke of Westminster, basically do take a massive take from what the rest of society does just because they are the land-owning classes.
And is it a bit like sort of Genghis Khan or something? You know, this land is my land because I fought for it, and I'll kill you if you don't get off.
Well, exactly. Ultimately, that's what it boils down to. And I think you see the case is for nationalising of land, and therefore any value that the land so everybody would rent land at any level. So say if the land was nationalised, everybody would bid for bits to use bits of it, and you'd obviously have to provide you'd have to agree to provide housing for everybody and all the rest of it. It's not mad stuff. This is the kind of thing they do in well run countries. And then, of course, all of the profits that are going to the Duke of Westminster at the moment goes back to pay for your social services and all the rest of it, so you can actually reduce things like income tax and value-added tax, because the land taxes, and land tax is really easy to collect because land doesn't run away. You can't hide it in the Cayman Islands. It's quite easy to tax land.
It sounds like you're agreeing with Henry and this idea of private ownership of land being somehow wrong, and potentially anyway, it being something which should be for the good of everyone and could potentially be nationalised.
Indeed, and if you're not going to go to the whole hog and nationalise it, what you do is you create a tax regime, which means that if you leave a place empty, it's basically taken off you. And, you know, you could have compulsory purchase orders on. I mean, it may be, for example, if it was agreed that they were going to buy these office spaces to turn them into houses, they'd have to compulsorily purchase them. So they'd have to have the power, basically, to take these things off them.
Well, we have to go back to 1235 on this subject to talk about land being privatised. Because, I mean, it's something we often forget, I think, about land, is that it has been privatised over the centuries. And that was, 1235 was a date of, under Henry III, of something called the Statute of Merton, which was the first ever enclosure or privatisation of land. And then there was gradual privatisation up until the English Civil War in the mid-1600s. And after that, when the merchant classes took over from the old feudal landowning classes, there was a massive acceleration of enclosure. So, Martin, I mean, I may be floating the boat out a little bit here, but do you think we're coming towards the end game of that privatisation of land, that actually we're finding now that the greed has got the better of the people that own it?
Well, it's not just land, is it? We're also talking about the financial services sector imploding and all of these things.
But the thing is, you don't
basically
need
our whole way of life.
Hang
is
on a second,
because
you don't need money. If you've got land, you've got a house on it, and you're producing stuff. You don't actually need.
But I mean,
you're creating stuff, and you're able to actually then
look,
use that
in
exchange.
In developing countries like Brazil, it makes absolutely great sense for people to think in terms of opting out of the system, growing their own food, or just selling a little bit of their surplus and so on. In a complex developed society like Britain, we could certainly do a lot more with the land than we do. We could actually have a lot more small holdings and all the rest of it. But we've still got 60 million people. They can't all be small holders. We have to have some kind of plan to use all of the capital equipment, all of the skills, all of the knowledge that our society has built up, which is actually going to waste now because the system is basically broke. And it's not just the landowning system that's broke, it's the capitalist system that's broke, full stop. It's broken.
Henry, I'll give you the final word on this. What are your thoughts about what we've been discussing about nationalising or private ownership of land, and also about your own situation, where you're going to be living in the next few weeks?
Well, I'm not hugely keen on the idea of nationalisation of land, because I'm not very keen on government having a very, you know, strong...
Well, you've said you don't want people owning land. That would mean the government owning it.
It would mean no one owning it. But it's not a commodity.
Isn't that what Marx is saying there, a bit of a free-for-all, where people are just fighting each other for bits of land?
I don't know. I'm not sure. I would like to go down that route and see what that brings. I can't say that whether it would be free-for-all or not.
Maybe we should get one county or a small area and do it in there and see what happens. I mean, it's an experiment.
Right. In terms of my future situation of housing, I really have no idea how it's going to go. I would like to pursue these issues. Whether I'll do that personally with my own resources or not, I'm not sure. Squatting will become more difficult now that it's commercial buildings. I'm quite keen on pushing that through and putting my own effort and my own resources into housing the people who rely on this. I don't rely on it. I can get housing benefit if I'm willing to compromise my principles, etc. Some people absolutely rely on it. So in terms of getting some kind of commercial building where people can actually live in there and make a go of it, is something to look into, and something which we are looking into.
Okay, and if people are interested, Bristol Housing Action Movement is on the internet at squatbristol.org.uk. Thanks very much, Henry, for being with us and sharing your experiences.
Thanks.
And now we'll finish up with an eviction. This is an eviction I recorded a lot long ago, so you can just have a listen to what it's like. This is about a minute or so of just recordings from outside an eviction. And that was the owners PG Group smashing their way back into their own building. Even though I don't really know if they had to use quite so much force to go through the windows as well, because they already had people in the doors. A little bit of chanting from the squatters. Yes, the bailiffs, not the most popular people amongst the squatters, Martin. Ultimately, we're faced with a situation here with more and more homeless and lots of empty buildings, so I don't think squatting's going away, is it?
No, I don't think it is, but they'll have to be better organised than they have been in the past if they're going to stand up to the repression that they're going to receive.
What makes you say that?
Well, I mean, the obvious thing to do is to concentrate on commercial buildings and to make sure that they're properly taken over and properly defended.
And now it's time for the What's On with Jeff Sparks. Hi, Jeff.
Hello, Tony. Hello, this is your What's On guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 12th of October, Fleetwood Mac tribute group Fleetwood Back will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Muse, Bristol. Tickets are £8 in advance and doors open at 7:30pm. Also on 12th of October, Metal Gods will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Temple Gate, Bristol. Entry is free and the gig starts at 9:30pm. On to Song of the Week, and I present John Otway. In a career that has spanned 40 years, he has achieved two hits, the first in 1977 and the second in 2002. In 1992, he released the album Under the Covers and Over the Top, which consisted of various songs he has covered. Here is one of those songs, and it's the Sweets Blockbuster.
Got a clue what to do. The cops are out. Oh, they're running about. Look, they don't know if they can block Buster out. He's got to be caught. He's got to be caught. But he's far more evil than anyone here ever thought.
Anyone know the way? Did we hear someone say?
We just haven't got a clue what to do.
With Blockbuster from the album Under the Covers and Over the Top. For more information on him, you can check out www.johnotway.com. Into Saturday, 13th October, Marina and the Diamonds will be performing at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Tickets are £20 in advance and doors open at 7pm. Finally, on Sunday, 14th of October, Freight will be performing at the Coronation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and the gig starts at 9 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening, and have a good week. Take care, and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Well, we were going to have something about magic mushrooms this week, but we'll do some of that next week. Because that's all for this week. Dialect's a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 2 p.m. every Friday afternoon. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to do, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And as promised, here's the number again for Bristol Bully Watch Helpline. That's 01454 318 753. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening, and so until the same time next week, goodbye. Planned to be.
and hope that you'll